Get started this evening. We're starting pretty much on time. My name is Pat Hume. I am the mayor of Elk Grove, and we are very excited to have all of you here tonight, and excited to have our congressman here to hold a town hall meeting. Those of you that are aware, I'm sure, that Congressman Dan Lundgren represents the 3rd Congressional District in California, and although he was re-elected to Congress in 2004, his prior tenure there about 2 decades earlier makes him one of the senior legislators working on the Hill today. His topics of interest are wide and varied. He sits on committees of budget, homeland security, and some of the judiciary. That was the other one. We also remember him as our attorney general here in the state of California, so he is very up to speed on a lot of the topics that affect us from a statewide and a judiciary perspective. I think he's been doing a wonderful job up there for us. We just learned specific to Elk Grove that he has advanced our request for appropriations to essentially turn this room into the Emergency Operations Center for Southern Sacramento County. While that certainly doesn't guarantee any funding, obviously getting his approval and moving it forward for us was our first hurdle, and so we're very happy that he was pleased to do that. At least I will assume he was pleased to do it, whether or not he did it reluctantly. But nonetheless, that is trying to bring some of our money back to our own community. And so I think that is, I can tell by some of the questions that are being asked, something that is of great concern. So without further ado, I introduce to you our Congressman Dan Lundgren.
Thank you very much, Pat. I appreciate that. I appreciate that very much. I like when I realized that maybe we'll be getting a little older when I realized that your mayor graduated from Connecticut High School 1 year before my son. All that means is he's done a lot at a very, very young age. So thanks, Pat. I appreciate you for doing this. We're going to have a little different format than we've had before. And the reason is, some people have come up to me and called me and come into the office and said some of our town hall meetings were getting so rambunctious they were afraid to come to them anymore. And some people told me they felt intimidated to ask questions. That's not the purpose of a town hall meeting. So what we're going to try is something a little different this time around, and that is, we've asked people to write out questions, and we'll collect them. The mayor will get them, and then we'll go through as many as we possibly can. He'll be asking the question. If there's two or three of the same, put them together and ask him. So if any of you have any questions now or questions during the process, just fill out the cards. I guess the cards are out there. And Oliver, my staff, will come by and get them. So once again, Mr. Mayor, thank you. And I appreciate you allowing us to have this space today. It was a pleasure to be here for the dedication of the Communication Center to the former chief, who has done an excellent job here. And I appreciate the work he did during the time that I was Attorney General and during the time that I was able to represent this area as the congressperson. Also, Steve Dittrich being here, we appreciate you coming, and we appreciate you being involved in the recognition of the chief. We also have from Consumus Community Services District, the Vice President, Joe. Thank you for being here. And thank all of you for coming. Let me just very briefly introduce members of my staff so that you might know who they are and you might know what their responsibilities are, because sometimes you call and you wonder who's the voice on the other end of the line, and sometimes you wonder who can help you with a particular matter or subject that you have an interest in. Peter Tatishi is my deputy chief of staff. Peter was with me for several years when I first started, and he went off on his own for a couple of years, and I brought him back as my deputy chief of staff. What has happened is that my chief of staff, a fellow named Victor Arnoldick, who was actually with me in Congress when I was there the first time around, who came back when I returned to Congress this time around as my chief of staff, has now gone over as the chief staff person, Chief of Staff for the Republican membership on the House Administration Committee, because I'm the ranking member or the leadership on the Republican side on that. You may ask, well, what is the House Administration panel basically, we sort of operate as the mayor of Capitol Hill, meaning we're supposed to make sure that the other members are doing what they're supposed to do. We're supposed to make sure that their offices operate the way they do. We answer the questions on how they can spend their money, what they can do, what they can't do. And that takes up a good deal of our time. Another part of what we do is that we take all election law through our committee. So if there's a contested election, as there was 2 years ago from a election down in Florida, we're the ones that go through that, make the final recommendation as to whether the contest should be approved or disapproved, that is, whether the members should be seated or unseated, new election order, that sort of thing. We don't do that very often, but when we do, it's a serious matter, and we act, I think, fairly well in a bipartisan fashion. The other thing we do on election law is any of the new laws dealing with the federal elections come through our committee. So that's one of the things we do. Peter is now my deputy chief of staff, so he spends about a week a month in Washington, D.C., 3 weeks a month back here, except when we have exceptional circumstances, and then he's back there even more often. His wife is sort of okay about it because his wife is a graduate of the military academy. She serves in the United States Army and is in Iraq right now and has been and will be there for 4 years. So. Peter was just back in Washington with me because we went through the appropriations process that we do. You've heard a lot, and I'll answer questions, I'm sure, if someone brings them up about earmarks or about requests for funds. What we do is we have told all those, whether cities, counties, interests, companies, etc., who want to see some sort of funding grant from the government as directed by the Congress, that they have to come to us and show that there's a federal nexus, meaning that there's some federal responsibility, some federal connection to what they're doing. Secondly, we require that they put in plain English what the request is, why it is being made, and we let them know that we will make it public. And what I do by that is when I submit a request for funding of this sort, we put it on my website so that anybody can instantaneously see what it is, who asked for it, how much it is, what the federal nexus is. And we go through a process. When I was first in Congress this time around, back in 2005, I think we had 180-some requests. After I made it clear that I was not going to make requests for things that had no federal nexus at all, it has been reduced so that this year we got 85 requests. Of that 85, we actually put 29 forward. Not because we think we'll get all 29, but because we don't know what the committees will say. We're not sure what their priorities are right now. So we give them a list of things that we think are important and can pass that test of federal nexus. And so we just did that this week. Marilyn Herbs is with my office. Marilyn is back there handing out some cards. Marilyn is administrative director. She lives just north of this community. Her son is also one of the outstanding detectives with the police department here in this community. Of course, she is very, very proud. She also helps in the appropriations process, manages outreach in the office, and federal legislative affairs in the district. Debbie Jones. Debbie Jones waving in the back. Debbie Jones is special assistant. She directs scheduling. So you're trying to get a schedule in the office when I'm back here in the district. She's the one you talk to. She also manages the district office budget, which is extremely important. Under the rules of the House, if we spend $1 more than we are given, it comes out of my pocket. So we make sure that that does not happen. She does a lot of other stuff for me, too. Alexandra Snyder, Alex, the tall lady in the back. She has been in my Washington, D.C. office for a year and a half. She's been out here in the district office for a year and a half. She's returning to the Washington office. Tomorrow will be her last day here in the district office. She is an attorney, and she's going to go back as one of my legislative assistants. She and her nephew are going to be driving across country this next week to join us back there. She's worked very hard on local governance issues, and what's important is she's gotten a year and a half experience dealing with local governance issues. which will help us back in Washington DC with my staff there, having someone who's had a personal opportunity to deal with most of the governments in this area, that is the cities, the counties that I represent. And she has assisted with legislative affairs in the district. She will be doing primarily legislative affairs in Washington, D.C. Josiah Pendergast is in the back, district rep. He goes all over the district, oftentimes up in my my mountain counties, so he puts a lot of miles on the car. He also coordinates the PAGE program. You know, we have a PAGE program in Washington, D.C. Juniors in high school, they can come and serve in the Congress. They actually go to school. If they get a PAGE appointment during the school year, they actually get up at 5 in the morning, go to school for 3 or 4 hours before they actually work. And they actually sit on the floor of the House responding to requests for members. But the great thing is they get a tremendous view of how the Capitol operates. And we've been privileged to have a number of people from our district serve as PAGEs. One young man was a foster child who I had known for some years. He got emancipated at 16, was in high school. He came back as a PAGE during the summer. We have 2 periods during the summer. He was so good they asked him to come back for the second period. And I might say now he is serving in the United States Navy, has served over in the war zone, is on a ship that is homeported out of Hawaii. And I got to see him for about 6 days about 2 months ago. He came up to the ranch that my wife and I have a little interest in up north. And I said, well, what can you tell me that's not classified that you have done that's the most exciting thing? He jumps out of those helicopters to rescue people. And he said his most exciting one was in the South China Sea, a sailor had gone overboard in another ship. The seas were 30 feet. They dropped him out of the helicopter. He went down and the sailor was panicking so much he had to actually knock him out in order to save him. And then he swam him. He was there thinking the helicopter could get them, but there was such rough seas. He swam over to the side of the ship and he thought they were going to drop a boat down, but it was too rough. So he then swam back out to where the helicopter was. They told him they couldn't handle it, so he swam back to the ship. They lowered a line over, and he rescued the sailor. And he said that's the most exciting thing he can talk about that's not classified. An outstanding young man, and they still ask about him back in Washington, D.C. It's a great program. If any of you have a young person who would be interested, you should let us know. Josiah helps coordinate that. There's also a Library of Congress internship. We have someone in that right now. Oliver Hsu. Oliver is the person you would talk to if you had any kind of an immigration question or issue. He also helps with military issues, workman's comp issues, postal service issues, Office of Personnel Management, and along with Michelle Panos. Michelle manages the Military Academy appointments. Now, I'm going to mention this one more time, Military Academy appointments. I'm very proud of the fact that as a member of Congress, I get to appoint young men and women to our academies. We have outstanding young men and women at the academies representing our areas. And it's available to anybody who is in the district, any young person. And so if you know of a young person who might be interested, let them please contact our office by their junior year, so we can make sure that they're doing the academics they need to do and also the extracurricular activities. It's an excellent opportunity for our education, and it is supposed to reflect the entire population, and that's why the appointments are made by members of Congress. Every member gets a certain number of appointments so that it's equalized around the country. Now, there's some additional ones. The superintendent of the academies gets some. There's some from the president. If you happen to be the offspring of a service man or woman who died in combat, you can get an appointment so long as you qualify. But most of them come through the offices, and Oliver helps us with that, and Michelle helps us with that. Michelle also does Veterans Affairs, Social Security, IRS, Medicare, and Department of State. Most of you are saying, you know, you don't want to be ambassadors. Why would you be worried about Department of State? That's called passports. And oftentimes, people call us at the last minute to get help on passports, and sometimes we can work magic. And Chris O'Connor is our congressional aide, and Chris is working the camera right here. And he helps coordinate federal grants programs and assists with constituent correspondence. So, last thing I would say on that is if you are interested in a tour, you're coming back to Washington, D.C., please let us know as soon as possible because we have limited numbers of tours we can get at the White House. The other thing is, if you're coming back and you have already seen the Capitol of the United States, you might want to take another tour because we just opened the Capitol Visitor Center. Now, you may have heard about it. It's kind of controversial because it cost too much and it took too long. A good part of the cost, the additional cost, was as a result of 9/11. It was started, it was designed, and the construction began before 9/11. After 9/11, they realized they had to do a lot more in terms of security, had to redesign it. There are a lot of other features there. That cost has gone up. But it is an extraordinary experience to see. The great hall that we get built there is called Emancipation Hall. It's called Emancipation Hall in honor of the slaves that actually helped build the United States Capitol before they were emancipated as a result of the Civil War. And they have some magnificent exhibits there, as well as some of the statues were moved out of the Capitol proper into the center. The one point I'd like to make on that is every state gets two statues in the United States Capitol represented. Does anybody have any idea who the two are that we have from California?
Mark Twain?
No. He did spend some time up here in Calaveras County.
John
Mueller? No. One of them is Father Unipersera. He's founded the missions. And the other one is Thomas Starr King. Who knows who Thomas Starr King is?
This is King's son.
That's true. Thomas Starr King was a writer and orator during the time of the Civil War, and he may be the person most responsible for persuading the state of California to stay with the North and not go with the South. But we are removing his statue, and it is coming back to California and will be in the state capitol, because on June 3rd at 11 a.m. in the rotunda of the capitol, we are putting another statue in his place. And who do you think that might be?
Reagan?
Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan. And on the base, I have to be on the committee that has to approve the statue and so forth, so we've been involved in this. I'll tell you a little secret. When I first saw the clay model of the statue, I thought it looked like Andy Griffith trying to play one. And some others did too. So we made some recommendations as to some changes they made. Mrs. Reagan made some specific changes. She said, and I shouldn't show you this right now, but she said that his pants were too long. He never had that much of a break in his pants. So they did bring that up and made some other touches on it. But the remarkable thing is, on the base of the statue, they're going to have a piece of the Berlin Wall. So that for generations, people coming there, young people coming, will get a sense of what the Cold War was and the president who helped end the Cold War. It's going to be in the rotunda. We're going to probably move most of the statues of presidents that represent states into the rotunda. And right now, if you're in the rotunda and you face the east door looking out, on the right side is the Kansas statue, one of the newest statues, of Dwight D. Eisenhower, as he appeared on D-Day. And on the left side, flanking the doors, will be Ronald Reagan. And so that's going to take place on the 3rd of June. We hope Mrs. Reagan will be strong enough to be there. That's one of the reasons we scheduled for that time. Let me just tell you about a couple of issues that we got back in D.C. You may have noticed we had a budget. I voted against the budget. I support an alternative budget. I'd be happy to answer questions about it. I'll just give you some very quick facts. The budget that passed has spending for this year at over $3 trillion. that's in excess of 25% of what they call GDP, gross domestic product, which is supposed to be a measure of the wealth of the nation, or the income of a nation in a single year, that is above the historical norm. The tax increases included in it are either $1.2 trillion, if you look at the figures given to us by the administration, or $1.5 trillion, if you look at the numbers done by the Congressional Budget Office. It will increase spending by $1 trillion over the next 5 years. The national debt, and look, I was one of those who complained about President Bush spending too much money and putting us in too much debt. So I try and take a bipartisan, nonpartisan view on this. I don't care who's spending too much. I think we're spending too much. But here's a historic fact. If the budget we adopted actually is the budget that we enforce over the next 5 years, you will take all the debt incurred by the United States government from the time of George Washington to George W. Bush, all of it together, we will double that in 5 years. And we will triple it in 10 years. Now, I know that we have some real calls on the federal budget. I know some people believe that we need to stimulate the economy right now. But I'm just one that just believes that that's too much spending and too much debt and too much taxing. So we're going to argue over that, and it's a legitimate argument to have. The other thing is there is a proposal that is before the Congress now on energy. It's called cap and trade. I call it cap and tax, and I'll tell you why. Senator Cardin, Majority Party from Maryland, said this week that the cap and trade is the largest single revenue enhancement in his lifetime. Something on that is what he said. Now, when he says, he's a pretty honest guy. What he's saying is it's a tax. And it's a $646 billion tax on us. And the question is, what are we going to do with it? If you're using it as a means to try and cut down on carbon production or carbon emissions, you might say you could establish it in such a way that would encourage people to use energy and other energy sources or energy systems that use less carbon, and you encourage people to do that by taxing those types of uses of energy that have greater carbon emissions. Okay, you can buy that argument. But then the question is, what do you do with the money? If all you want to do is to use it as a means to control certain types of energy pollutants, as you would see them to be, then you'd take that money in that way and you'd return it to the people. In other words, you use it to influence people's decisions as to what kind of energy they would use, but you wouldn't use that money to make government bigger. In other words, you would say, all right, we'll send it back to the people, and we'd figure out how to send it back to the people. That would be a way by which you would use the tax code to direct certain kind of conduct which you think is appropriate for purposes of saving the planet, if you believe that human activity is the major producer of CO2 or is such a contributor to CO2 that we can specifically change the impact on the planet. But that's not what the budget has in mind. The budget takes that $646 billion and makes it more spending on the government. And so you have to ask yourself, is that where we want to go? Is that what we want to do? So these issues that we have on the budget are extremely important. Stimulus package is extremely important. Should we be spending this amount of money? How do we handle the homeowners situation that's affecting us? Where you see the great number of foreclosures we've seen, where you see certain programs that are trying to help people but they don't help other people. How do we engage in such a way that that makes sense? Those are all issues that are before us right now, and those are issues that I'd be happy to talk about depending on what your questions are, because I could go on and on and on about my questions, but I think maybe, since this is a town hall and we'd like to find out what you have to say, we'll go to some questions here.
Thank you, Congressman. For those of you that just came in, there are some seats sprinkled here in the middle. If you'd like to come down and sit, and maybe those of you that are already sitting can make that as easy as possible. If you came in late, it is a slightly different format in that there are questions being put on the cards and then collected by the congressman's staff so that I can kind of bundle them together. And I want to do that. I'll start with what seems to be a pervasive theme in some of these, which has to do with respect to congressional authority with regard to spending and how can the taxpayers curtail spending and regain some of the trust in the government in light of the meltdown that has happened. And then there's some other questions a little more specifically to some of the answers there.
Well, spending is a two-part process in Washington, D.C. Actually, a three-part process. Let me mention it. Two of the parts go with the Congress. One part goes with the President. The two parts that go to the Congress are these. We have what are known as authorizing committees and appropriating committees in the House. Some think that you ought not to have two. You could just have one. Same thing happens in the Senate. And what that means is, for instance, I'm on Judiciary Committee. We authorize the activities and therefore set ceilings on the expenditures of the Justice Department, for instance. And that means how many attorneys they can hire. That has to do with how many agents the FBI has. And so we have that sort of thing that we do. I'm on the Committee on Homeland Security. We're the ones responsible for creating the authorization for the activities of Homeland Security Department. Within that is, for instance, the Coast Guard. So how big should the Coast Guard be? How many ships should they have? How many planes should they have? What is their proper role in terms of security in our seaports? What's their proper role in terms of protecting the oceans? What's their proper role in terms of assisting us on trying to keep drugs out of this country? What's their proper role in assisting us on trying to interdict those who would try and come to this country illegally? So that's the authorizing committee. Then we have what's known as the appropriations committee. And then they officially come in and they produce appropriation bills which establish the actual amount of dollars that they can spend. So we may authorize up to $450 million for something. They could authorize $230, but they couldn't go above $450. Sometimes authorizing committees say such sums as are necessary, which is kind of an open-ended book, and then you just find out from year to year to year. So the appropriations committees do that. They have to pass both houses of the Congress, and then they have to go to the President for signature. The President can veto it. So in two ways, the way the Congress acts and the way the President acts by way of veto or signing the bill, you can control spending. Let me just explain one thing about our budget, why the federal budget is different than the state budget, because we've all heard about what happens in the state budget. You don't have a budget, the state can't send out the checks and that sort of thing. For the state of California, budget means their appropriation process. When the state has a budget they adopt, that allows the spending to go on for the state. When we have a budget is a document initiated by the President. He sends it over to us. It's his idea of what we ought to be spending. We then pass budgets that pass both the House and the Senate, but they never go to the President for signature. They're concurrent resolutions, meaning that they're supposed to control our activities in the House and in the Senate. We can waive them by our own rules. We can have a budget waiver when a bill comes up. So in a sense, it is supposed to be the blueprint for our spending. But we can violate that blueprint anytime we vote, majority votes in either the House or the Senate to do so. The President never gets a chance to sign the final budget because it doesn't go to him as a law, meaning it doesn't have the force of law. So if you're looking at the federal level, you have to look at the authorizing and then the appropriating bills. And so when we had the stimulus package, that was an appropriation bill. When we had the omnibus spending bill recently, that was an appropriation bill. That's where the rubber really meets the road in terms of spending. And I think the problem in Congress is too many people want to be Santa Claus, no one wants to be Scrooge. In other words, no one wants to say no, everybody wants to say yes. And I will tell you this, we have a lot more people coming to Washington, D.C. telling us to spend your money than we have people coming back saying don't spend your money. And it's particularly this time of year, this is known as appropriation time. We had to have all our requests in by last Friday. Now the appropriating committees go through their process and see what kind of spending. We've already been told the president wants to send up another, well, no, the Speaker of the House wants another stimulus package.
In relation to that, another theme of the questions here, with respect to spending, is where the money is going. And so you mentioned the stimulus package. There are a couple of questions here with relation to the bailout package that happened last year with respect to the banks and why spending is going towards financial institutions and including IMF and foreign financial institutions rather than helping out the taxpayers. And then how do we avoid double-digit inflation with all of this money going around?
I voted for the first TARP bill and then voted against everything since then. Maybe I learned my mistake. Let me give you the arguments why the first TARP bill passed. The Secretary of the Treasury and the head of the Federal Reserve, Mr. Bernanke, came to us in Congress. I sat on the Budget Committee at that time, so they came and testified to us there. But they also came to us in our various meetings. The Democrats called their meeting a caucus. We Republicans called ours a conference. Basically, it means the meeting of all members of each party. And they met with us individually and they said, look, we have this terrible economic calamity coming down the road. And if we don't do something, it's going to be worse than anybody thinks. And one of the things that has occurred is that the banks are about ready to fail in a major way and we have to do something about it. And some of us asked the question, well, why should we do this with respect to the banks? And if you look at history, one of the things you'll find is the founding of the Republic, a pretty smart guy named Alexander Hamilton, made the point that you can't have a democracy operate, you can't have a society operate unless they have a working banking system. There was some argument about that, but there was general acceptance of the fact that we needed a banking system. If the banking system fails, the entire economy goes down. So if there is government intervention in one area over others, it may be in the area of banks. Or look at it this way. If you look at the economy as a human body, the banks are the circulating system that circulates the oxygenated blood throughout the system. And the oxygenated blood essentially is your currency, is the money. If you don't have the money flowing, people can't transact business. We can't do those things. It gums up the works. It stops everything. It's like a huge, massive blood clot that's going to kill the patient. So the question is, how do you intervene? The original proposal brought to us was $700 billion, no strings attached. Secretary of Treasury could do anything he wanted. We couldn't have any control over it. And besides, they said they already had some powers, at least the Federal Reserve had some powers from laws going back to the 1930s that gave them the ability to the Federal Reserve to send out boatloads of money. We said, basically, there was not a majority to pass that proposal. We said, no, we want to put some strings on it. We want to put some restrictions on it. We want to say you have to come back to Congress after you let out the first half of it. We want to put some restrictions going forward on limits on certain executive pay and severance packages with people that might be assisted by this. And we also bought the argument that they were going to try and buy toxic assets. What's a toxic asset? That's, you know, banks have on their book assets against which they've lent money. It's their capital. Toxic assets are ones that have just lost their value in some significant way. And the question is right now, when you have a market which is so bad that you can't sell an asset, is that asset worth zero? I mean, it might be a building. You know it's not worth zero. But if you have what's called mark-to-market, where you have to mark exactly what the value is at that instant, if you can't sell it, it's worth zero to you. Even though you know that's not right because it's a building, it's land. I mean, you know you've got some intrinsic value there. So that was one of the big issues we had. And what we said was, all right, you can have that money, but you use that money to try and remove some of these toxic assets off the books of some banks that otherwise are healthy, sequester them for a while, as they did in Sweden when they had a problem, but don't do what they did in Japan, which is let bad banks continue, zombie banks, can't really work, pretend that there's not a problem, and just have stimulus package after stimulus package after stimulus package, which resulted in what's known as a lost decade in Japan. Well, they said, okay, that's what we're going to do. Well, as soon as they got the authority, they went and decided, no, that's not what we're going to do. We're going to take that money, we're going to capitalize these banks instead. we're not going to do anything with the toxic assets. Burden. Then they used the money not just for banks, but for other things. Because they said the legislation was broad enough to allow that. That's not what they told us. That's not what we thought was happening. And they got into a lot of other areas. I'm afraid what we're doing is we're following the Japanese experience, which is called an ad hoc approach. We're going to pick this winner here. We're going to pick this loser there. We're going to intervene here. We're not going to intervene there. I don't think people are smart enough to figure out who all the winners and the losers are, and I don't think government is. And Japan tried that, and it didn't work. Sweden, on the other hand, in the 1990s, saw they had a problem, concentrated on the financial systems, the banks. They allowed them to sequester the toxic assets in set-aside banks. There was some support for the government from the government. Now, they went a little bit too far. They went and nationalized some banks. But the point is, they sequestered this. They saw banks that were badly managed, that really didn't have any good assets, and they let them go down. They let them fail. And within 3 years, they righted their financial system. I would hope that's what we would do. Unfortunately, I think we're going in the wrong direction on this. And a number of years ago, I was in the Congress, and I helped rewrite the bankruptcy laws. And I helped rewrite Chapter 11. And at the time we did that, we tried to make Chapter 11 a process by which companies that were having true difficulty could go in and see if they could be reorganized and continue. Not that they would sell off all their assets, but to make the last effort to see if they could continue. And so we gave authority to bankruptcy judges to bring all of the parties to the table, make all of them put their cards on the table. Then the bankruptcy judge, following the law which says, do what you can do to try and make this a viable institution, would basically say, with the force of law, you're going to have to give here, you're going to have to give here, you're going to have to give here, you're going to have to give here. No one's going to get everything they want, but this is the best chance we've got to make this company survive. They did it with Delta Airlines. But what are we doing? We go, and we got GM, and we got Chrysler, and they come to town. And they say, we can't go through bankruptcy. Why not? Well, we just can't do it. Well, why not? Because if we go to bankruptcy to reorganize, no one will buy our cars. Well, they're not buying a whole lot of your cars right now. And you think because the government makes a promise they're going to do that? My argument has been they ought to go through bankruptcy, not to fail, but to see if they can succeed. And the sooner we do it, the better we're going to find that out, and the less taxpayer dollars are going to be wasted. Instead, we've been going through bankruptcy light. And why do I say that? When you don't go through the bankruptcy court process, what you do is you go through kind of a phony or a foul, a pseudo or a, yeah, it's kind of like bankruptcy, but it's not right. And the reason I say that is if you don't like what you have to give up to make it work, you go running to Washington, you go to the President, you go to the Secretary of the Treasury, you go to the Congress, and you bring your lobbyists there. Nothing wrong with lobbyists, but I mean, that's what you do. And you try and get out from under what you have to do to make this thing viable. Why? Because you say, we'll just have the taxpayers put in a few billion dollars more to take care of it. And I'm going to tell you, it is just dead wrong. And now we see GM's preparing for bankruptcy. Well, they should have done that 6 months ago. They should have realized what they had to do, and they would stand a better chance of surviving. Now, I wake up in the morning, I pick up the newspaper, or actually going online and see my virtual newspaper, and it says President Obama has told the CEO of GM he's got to leave. Now, I wouldn't mind that if that were the bankruptcy judge saying it. But I do have a problem where you've got this president or any president making the decision that this CEO should go or this board of directors ought to go or this is the car they're supposed to build because, frankly, they don't know a doggone thing about building cars. I don't either. And what we've done is we've traded a process that we established that was across the board treating all industries the same. You go in, you prove your point. You have to argue your point. Everybody does. A judge makes a determination. And no one, I mean, people don't get, everybody doesn't get what they want. But people are satisfied they've been treated right. And I'm just worried right now that we've got government in Washington going more and more into this, making more and more decisions. I don't know if you saw this, where the Secretary of Treasury, the Obama administration, has told banks that want to give all the money back, but they can't do it. Why? Because if you give it back, then the government can't tell you what to do. And I, again, you know, I'm part of governments. I mean, I work my every day on this. But frankly, there's some things we do well, and there's some things we don't do well. And I've lived long enough to look at the European experience where government interferes with the economy to a far greater extent than we do. And all I know is traditionally they have higher unemployment rates, higher inflation rates, lower standard of living. They don't have the creativity that we do. They don't have the inventions that we do. They don't have the advances in science and medicine the way we have. And frankly, I don't think we ought to trade our experiences for that experience.
Sure. One more general area of concern regarding finances, and then we can move on to another subject here. But this has to do perhaps with people who have not walked away from their obligations and are trying to keep themselves afloat. And it's the federal homeowners assistance program and involving homeowners' stability and affordability plans. What do you see as far as loan modifications happening?
Well, we have slightly different approaches. The administration has come up with a $15,000 tax credit for first-time home purchasers. We happen to think on our side that it ought to be applied to any home purchaser, because in some cases, a person who's buying their second home or a person who's refinancing is going to put themselves in a position that will benefit themselves and society. In terms of getting out from under a bad situation. We also are trying to suggest that what ought to be done is incentives put on both the lender and the borrower to renegotiate it. And our proposal is that if there's a successful renegotiation terms of the loan, either principal or interest, or principal and interest, that the benefit that then derived by the homeowner, which technically under the tax code is viewed as a gift and therefore taxable, would not be taxable. But in order to get this treatment, the homeowner would give up some of the appreciation for the house if the house is later sold, and that appreciation, a portion of that would go to the lender. So what you're trying to do is encourage the lender to start seriously renegotiating these loans. But they've got to say, look, we're getting hammered by the government because we made bad loans. We're getting hammered because we didn't do a good job. You've got to show us something that's in the interest of the bank to remain a stable bank. So you say, okay, part of your new asset is you will gain a portion of the appreciation of the house when it is sold at a later date. And so that is a proposal that we're trying to bring forward to see if that will make some sense. I mean, look, part of the problem is how do you distinguish between someone who is in trouble through no fault of their own and someone who got into a mess that they never should have been in the first place. We have found, unfortunately, a not insignificant number of defaults that are defaults on the first payment or the second payment. Now, when someone defaults on the first or second payment, there's a suggestion that maybe that was not a loan they ever thought they could actually achieve. We've also found that, interestingly enough, with refinancing. Significant number of refinances where default is taking place. It's taking place without a single payment being made or after one payment's being made. Now, I don't think we ought to set up a system which tries to say, okay, we're going to take care of that. I think we try and devise a system which helps people who are making a genuine effort to try and buy a home and these other things be dealt with.
Very good. Okay, there's a two-part question here that changes gears a little bit, and you actually kind of touched on it in talking about some differences here in ideas. The first is with respect to the Republican Party, and first of all, some of the round and round that went Rush Limbaugh saying that he wanted the president to fail, and then what happened with he and Michael Steele, and comments by Michelle Bachmann. And so the question generally is what is the status of the Republican Party and who is leading it? And then the follow-up, second part question of that is given that President Obama ran on a platform of change, and the people voted for that change, and he's at least set about for some bipartisan cooperation, what do you see as the roles of reaching across the aisle, and how do the two parties work together?
That's two parts. Only two parts. Well, let me see if I remember the first part. That is about Rush Limbaugh. Look, I've never spoken to Rush Limbaugh, so I can't tell you what he said, and I didn't hear the comment he made. I understand what he basically said was, I don't want the president to succeed, or I'm not working to see the president succeed. Then I heard him explain what he meant was, if I oppose what the president's philosophy is and where he wants to take government, no, I don't want him to succeed then. I would say this. Look, my wife and I have had the privilege of being at the White House. The president invited the leadership over, and as a result of my position on House administration, I'm considered a leader on the Republican side. So it was a very nice event. The president had probably 160 of us over, including spouses. It was in the East Room of the White House. There was a reception beforehand. Got to talk with him very briefly. We got to speak with him. Seated us at tables, I had the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development sitting next to me. Also had Chuck Schumer sitting next to me. Well, actually, Chuck was actually my wife's dinner partner. It's really kind of funny because my wife had a conversation with somebody saying, how do you guys stand one another? And he turns out to be her dinner partner. It was very, very interesting. But all I can say is, and I mean this sincerely, President Obama is a difficult person to dislike. What I mean is he's a very engaging individual. He's appeared before our Republican conference. He appeared before us before he appeared before the Democratic caucus and spoke in a meeting in a room about 1.5 times this size, and he was engaging, and he was open, and he said, I want to work on a bipartisan basis. And this was when he came to talk about the stimulus package, and we had to tell him, well, Mr. President, we appreciate it. In fact, the chairman of our conference said, Mr. President, one thing I want you to know right now is we pray for you every day, and that's true. And then he said, but you must know that you talked about bipartisanship. We've been read out of the stimulus package. In other words, we were not allowed to have any participation in it. We were just asked to vote on it at the very end. And at that time, I thought that the president had subcontracted out the stimulus package to Speaker Pelosi and to Harry Reid in the Senate, and that they'd gone further than he wanted to go, and therefore he couldn't bring them back off the cliff when he'd done that. After we received his budget, I'm not sure that's the case. He has a very specific vision of where he wants us to go as a government, and I don't share that vision. I don't suggest he's insincere. I suggest he's very sincere about it. But he has a very different approach, which does have larger government, does have larger taxes, does have larger spending. And that is a legitimate argument to make. And I appreciate it. But I don't believe that argument makes sense, because I can't look anybody here in the eye and tell you that the budgets that we've adopted will give us the debt that we can pay back in my lifetime. I've got grandkids now. My grandkids will not be able to pay back this debt that we're imposing on them. And if you look at it realistically at what we are imposing on us down the line, it is unsustainable. It cannot be sustained. So I have to say, with all due respect to him as president, and I do have respect for him as president, I don't agree with you on this, Mr. President. And I will not support you on this. Now, he just had, I will say this, he's at outreach, he's had his legislative representative come in and see me, and we sat for an hour in my office. She wanted to know what my priorities were. This week, I think it was Melissa Hathaway, came in to see me. She is in charge of a 90-day review of cybersecurity for the president. I happen to be the ranking member of the cybersecurity subcommittee. And I told her straight off, I said, I agree with the president on this being a real issue for us, a top concern. You wouldn't believe the thousands of times a day that the Pentagon is under attack in a cyber way. You wouldn't believe the number of times the Congress is. You wouldn't believe the number of times American businesses are. I just saw something on the internet tonight, and I don't know, I can't validate it, but it said that the U.S. military spent $100 million in the last 6 months protecting against the cyber attacks that are hitting it. And when you understand how much the cyber world means, the world of computers and computer networking, how much that means to us and everything we do now, you realize how important that is. So I told her, I said, I agree with the president on this, I want to work with you on this. We went through a whole bunch of things that we're going to work together on. But I said, I disagree with him on these other areas, and I cannot support him on that. So if what Rush Limbaugh was trying to say was, look, I do not look forward to him succeeding in those areas, and I hope he fails in those areas, I understand what he's saying. I wouldn't use that language. Some people thought it was somewhat intemperate. Then your second question had to deal with,
is there a role for bipartisanship, or what would you do in order for you to reach across the aisle?
Well, we try to do it. I mean, you got to realize, in the last days of the Congress, the last week we were in session last year, while Joe Biden was running for vice president on a ticket that I did not support, I worked with Joe Biden to get legislation passed to grant new authority so that we can go after what's called semi-submersibles. These are these long boats that can submerge maybe 3 feet down, that are built in the jungles of Costa Rica, that allow people, a crew of about five people, to bring tons of drugs into this country. And what happens is when our Navy or our Coast Guard comes upon them, they scuttle the ships. And without the evidence, instead of us prosecuting them, it turns into a search and rescue. I mean, our guys go and rescue these guys. So we changed the law so that it's illegal to operate these semi-submersibles. We can convict them just based on that. And Joe Biden and I worked on that for the 3 weeks until the last day. It was either the last day or the second last day. So there are things you can do to reach across the aisle and work with people. I work every day in my Homeland Security Committee. I work on Judiciary Committee on some things. One of the disturbing things I've seen is this, is we've had a collegial atmosphere on some of those committees where we've actually worked on a bipartisan basis, and then it gets out of our committee and goes to the Rules Committee, and before it gets to the floor, it's changed with stuff that would not have been agreed to on a bipartisan basis, and the Speaker has put it in there. And that's happened on at least two or three of the bills that I've worked on. And that kind of destroys a bipartisan nature of activity.
There you go. Okay, switching gears just a little bit. I'll start trying to work from very broad down to a little more specifically. The next subject here would be with respect to illegal immigration and some of the what is seen as American taxpayer money being spent on illegal immigrants, identity theft for illegals who steal identity, 30% of our prison population, illegal drugs coming from Mexico, border security, and then asked specifically about H.R. 1162, which is an amendment to, it looks like, E-2 visa. And this allows non-immigrant investors to gain permanent resident status as long.
Okay. Look, I've never been an immigrant basher, but I've been one who's believed that we need to secure our borders. I've worked very hard on that for 30 years. A couple things I would say. One is, I just heard some disturbing news today, and that is the chairman of the House subcommittee that deals with the census, you know, we got the census coming up, has just said that we ought to not be as vigorous in our enforcement of the immigration laws so that we can get a bigger census. Now, because you know what the census says? The census is a requirement for us to be numerous. Let me break down. It says in the Constitution that we must enumerate the number of think they use the word people or residents in the United States once every 10 years. It does not say citizens. So literally, anybody who is actually a resident here, if you happen to be an exchange student from a foreign country, you are counted. So his suggestion was we ought not to be vigorous in pursuing those who are here illegally so that we have a bigger count. I don't agree with that, as you might imagine. It seems to me we ought to have enforcement and it ought to continue.
Should they not count the slaves and the women then?
Okay.
I don't know what that means.
Well, the Constitution didn't originally include women as slaves. Except as...
Mike, we have a new format here tonight.
But if it's truly a town hall meeting, we should be able to count it too.
Women were counted, number one. And number two, slaves were counted as less than a whole, not because the slave states asked for that. The non-slave states asked for that so that the slave states would not have greater representation in the House of Representatives and make it more difficult to get rid of slavery at some point in time. So it's kind of an interesting thing for people to say that slaves were counted as less than fully human. That was the free states that asked for that so that the slave states would not have as great a power. No, the point is that you count all the people that are here. Look, illegal immigration is a very, very difficult issue. It's one that we've got to get our hands around. I've worked very hard on it over the years. I think you have to do any number of things. So one is you have to secure the border. You do have to have some interior enforcement. You do have to come to grips with the fact that we have a significant number of people who've been here for a long period of time who have some roots in the community. What do you do with those people? I've tried to fashion a compromise which would allow a certain type of legal status that could be acquired if they did several things, had no record of other criminal activity, learn English, learn civics, do community service, but don't put them on the road to automatic citizenship. Allow that status to be reaffirmed every 5 years, and if they want to become a citizen or on the path to citizenship, they go to their home country and get back of the line. Now, some people think that that's not enough. Other people think that that's too much. That's my attempt to try and get a compromise. I think at some point in time, we have to have a temporary working program that actually works where we control it rather than it's uncontrollable. And when you're talking about the visa that gentleman was talking about, look, in the 1960s, late 60s, early 70s, we changed our immigration policy in the United States to put an emphasis on family reunification. And what we did was we put greater numbers of greater visa availability to family reunification and expanded the definition of family. So it wasn't just the nuclear family, father, mother, brother, sister, but it extended beyond that. And we limited the number of other kinds of visa, including the investment visa. We used to have a visa, and we still do, but very, very small number. If someone had a set amount of money and they were coming to the United States for purpose of investment that would create jobs, we would grant them visas in certain numbers. We lessened that number, number one. Number two, we lessened the number of people that are available to come in on what's known as the H-1B visas, which are skilled people. And oftentimes, those would be people from foreign countries who came to the United States to get their master's and their doctorates, engineering and science and so forth, and then applied to have a visa to work in the United States. We're so tight on those right now that it's easier after they graduate from a United States college or university to go to Canada and work there than here. And as a result, Microsoft moved a facility, or actually opened a facility right across the border in Vancouver where they have 1,000 employees, because the base of the employment there were these people who've been educated in the United States couldn't get H-1B visas here in the United States to get them over in Canada. So we lost about 1,000 jobs. I don't think that makes much sense.
Okay, that's a good segue in moving into something that is also a great expense for businesses, and that's healthcare. And one in the health insurance, for mandated health insurance with respect to workers' comp and health insurance for the employees. And then also the fact that there's some delivery of special care services already being rationed for uninsured, and how would you propose healthcare reform that would change that? And then the final one is, do you support Conyers HR 676, single-payer healthcare?
I've not seen John Conyers' bill. I know John very well. We work on a lot of things together, but knowing his approach to certain things, I probably would not be supporting his proposal on that. I'm just going to admit to you, I don't have all the answers about healthcare. But I don't know anybody else who does. I think there are a number of things we can do, and a number of things we should do. One of the things there seems to be basic agreement on is that we should move to electronic record keeping for a number of reasons. One is, if you create a system where it's portable, that is, no matter where you are, you could latch on to your records by you having your password. So if you were traveling somewhere in the United States and you got ill or in an accident, they could access your records. They would have access to your medical history immediately where they might not have it otherwise. Secondly, it will make up for some of the mistakes that are made in terms of trying to read doctors' writings stop that. Thirdly, it will stop some of the contraindicated medicines that you might get otherwise. If they don't know what your history has been precisely, or you can't remember it in some ways, or if you have a particular medication being given by this doctor that you may not remember, it might not be the right drug to get from another doctor. And we think that that will help and actually get some savings in that regard. The big question for the government is, how do we put that in place? Do we provide incentives? Do we provide direct grants? Do we provide tax credits or tax deductions for doctors and hospitals and medical systems to come together? Do we put standards on them so that they're compatible? Should they be doctor-based or office-based or hospital-based or system-based? I mean, those are serious questions, because there's going to be an initial capital investment. Now, some of the stimulus money was established for that purpose. We'll see how well that's going to go. Third, it seems to me, one of the things we want to do is to try and provide greater access to health care for a particular category of individuals, which is a significant amount of those that don't have coverage right now, and that would be with those who are working for small or medium-sized employers who, at this point in time, find they can't afford coverage for their employees. One of the things we've tried to work on and to expand is called health associations, where businesses can band together and set up systems whereby they might be able to pool their resources and create a larger pool of individuals to be covered so that rates might be able to come down. There are a number of studies being done both on the Democratic and Republican side and on a bipartisan basis to try and bring these things together. The one thing I do not believe we ought to do is to have the federal government take it over. And somebody put it pretty well to me the other day. He said, look, if you only have one set of pictures of your parents and your grandparents, it's the only thing you got, and for whatever reason you can't make copies of them, you want to send them to your children living in another part of the country. This is what this person said. They said, would you send them by U.S. mail or would you send them by FedEx? I said, I'd probably send him to that. He said, why? I said, well, just in my experience, I think I'd have a better chance of getting there. He said, if that's what you would do with pictures of your family, why would you then entrust the health of your family to government? And the point I think he was trying to make is that there are certain inefficiencies in a governmental apparatus that may not be beneficial in a healthcare setting. And so while we might have to have government in some areas requiring transparency, I'll give you a simple example of where we can improve and what we have done. We have hospital infections that amount to a considerable number of illnesses that people otherwise wouldn't have. deaths that we wouldn't have otherwise, and tremendous expense involved. I mean, when I went in for my hip surgery last year, I wanted to get out of the hospital as quickly as possible. Not because the hospital had a bad reputation, just, actually, I had a friend I went to high school and college with, who was later a star in the NFL, who had double hip surgery and died 6 months later from infection. And one of the things that I think improves that is transparency. If we require all hospitals to report by service the rates of infection, and so the public knows it as well as doctors know it, I guarantee you those infections will come down. If they know that everybody's going to know exactly what those are going to be, I might say to my doctor, look, I don't want to go to that hospital. I'm sorry. And so that's one of the areas where it's a fairly simple thing for government to require that to be done. We're not interfering with the practice of medicine, but we're saying, make sure those facts are out there so people can make their judgments. I think those kinds of areas, we do a very, very good job. You look at the Canadian system, some people say that's superior to ours. I don't believe that to be true, but at least as I analyze the Canadian system, the only way the Canadian system can work is if you have pressure valves, safety valves. And the safety valves for the Canadian system are called Seattle, Minneapolis, and New York. And not really. I mean, the other thing is, where is most of the remarkable progress made in terms of new drugs and new medical procedures? It's in the United States. Now, there's some in other countries, but the core of it is in the United States. And I don't want to lose that.
I'm forgetting all the sound.
That doesn't mean that there aren't other things that we can't do and improve on. But I think as we're attempting to improve on it, we don't want to lose what good parts of our system.
And just to follow up on that, I've received a question that relates to it and that also ties back to one of the original questions with respect to businesses and tying healthcare, linking it as a benefit to employment, or whether or not that should be borne in some other way.
Well, if you analyze our medical delivery system, one of the things you'll find is that during World War II, we had restrictions on wages and prices. It's called wage and price controls. One area that was not controlled were benefits. So healthcare became attached to companies who were able to offer their employees more, not by violating the law on wage or price controls, but by giving them health benefits. That's how the third-party system really developed in this country. It's an, if you will, it's an accident of the it's an accident of the attempt by government to control wages and prices during World War II. But it became established. And it was not taxable, right? Your health benefit was not taxable that you got from your employer. So if you think about it for a moment, if it's not taxable, what happens when things are not taxable versus those that are taxable? You get more of what you get when you don't tax it, which is usually a good thing. But when the employer, the insurance policy that the employer pays a significant portion of becomes the main payer for the services you have, your tendency is not to be as concerned about the cost for you personally because you don't see it. Now, you're paid for it through your insurance and by what your employer is now putting into healthcare as opposed to your employer paying you. But you don't see it. It's not reflected in your paycheck. And so over time, it tends to create an imbalance in what the costs are versus what the services are. So how do you adjust that? And one of the suggestions is, I mean, John McCain's suggestion in the last campaign was, look, what we do is we allow the employer to give you a certain amount, $5,000. And then you go out and use that $5,000 to purchase your health care. And then we will give you a tax credit up to $5,000. Above that, you're going to be taxed on. The idea was to try and get the patient directly involved in making the decisions as to what kind of care they want. You set minimum standards. Now, is that one way of doing it? I don't know. When John McCain threw it out, he was, I would say, viciously attacked for it. And then we've seen some people in the Obama administration presenting part of that as part of their proposal. The point is, it's very difficult to deal with this. Because no matter how you deal with it, somebody is going to feel that they're losing something they otherwise have a right to. I just know this, if we don't do something to control the cost of Medicare and Medicaid, or as we call it, California Medi-Cal, it's going to overwhelm the entire federal, it and Social Security will overwhelm the entire federal budget by the time my children, or actually before my children are retired.
I don't know where that originated, but it's for you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Someone said, could you address the audience instead of Pat? Yeah, that's it. Actually, it. I would say it's more enjoyable, but I won't say that. Okay, ask me a question, Pat.
All right, here we go. Then moving locally here, we're seeing the talks of a peripheral canal come up again and diverting water around into pumping plants for Southern California purveyors. Do you, what's your stance on the peripheral canal, and what's your stance on the Bay Delta conservancy and restoration of the Delta? Does the federal government play a role?
Half of my friends are for the peripheral canal, and half of my friends are against the peripheral canal. I stand without any exception with my friends. Let me put it this way. Whatever happens, it's not going to be called the peripheral canal. They're calling it the roundabout. They're calling it everything else. I'm not an expert on this, but I'll tell you this, going back to 11 years ago when I ran for governor and I tried to make water and transportation and infrastructure an issue in my campaign. Some of you may remember that campaign. Most of you don't. I ended up being the stealth candidate. It was not my intention to be the stealth candidate, but it sort of ended up that way. I do know this. This state is so vast and so large, and there are more things that bind us together than tear us apart. But one of the things that's always had the potential of tearing us apart is water. But the fact of the matter is, water is dispersed throughout this state. And the question is, how do you have it dispersed in an efficient and economic way which does not destroy this part of the state which has the water before it moves somewhere else? And how do you do it in such a way that we enhance the health of the Delta rather than destroy the health of the Delta? Now, if you will look at it, that the governor, I think, is trying to say, look, the one legacy he wants to leave as governor is having a successful solution to this plan, or this problem. And he has set up this statewide effort, headed up by Phil Eisenberg, former state legislator from the Sacramento area. The concern I have is this right now, and I've discussed it with some of the governor's people, because I represent a part of the Delta. Some of the folks in the Delta have felt that if you look at the plan they've talked about, it seems to relegate local elected officials to the sidelines and have them overcome by regional. Now, the governor's people are saying they've heard it and they're going to try and do something to deal with that. Secondly, I'm concerned because if you look at the plans for the quote-unquote peripheral canal or roundabout or whatever they're calling it, it actually goes right through my district. And it's important that they do it right. We need more water collection and retention in this state for both north and south. We have found that almost impossible to do. I don't know how you are going to collect more water unless you build some systems that collect water. And when I was a kid, they were called dams. But you can't build them now. The Auburn Dam project just lost its water rights. State Water Board just took it away from them because they didn't act in the last 30-some years. If you want to see the best protection from a huge devastating flood from the American River, we're doing everything we can in modifying Folsom Dam. There's a bipartisan agreement on that. The only way we get to 500-year flood protection is if we actually were to build another dam upstream. It had been located at Auburn. We're not going to do that now. So I don't know what to do. The governor's got a couple of dams, one down at Sites, and I forget where the other one is. Are we going to go forward with that? It's an unbelievable problem. When I go back to Congress, I talk with members from the Central Valley just down from here. There is either zero or now maybe 10% water delivery to the farmers on the west side of the valley this year. Now, you know what zero delivery or 10% delivery does? It means you can't grow anything. And we're talking about some areas in the Central Valley where they're talking about 40% unemployment this year. And the problem is, as bad as that is, I don't know whether we have gotten the unified effort in this state to put forward something that's going to work. The other problem is there is no perfect solution. Believe me, there's no perfect solution. And there are a lot of people searching for that perfect solution. We're going to have an improved transportation of water through our area, through the Delta and the Southern California. What we need to do is to make sure that in the process of building that, they do things which protect our water rights here, and it can be done, and at the same time, work to improve the health of the Delta, and that can be done. Now, I talked to some of my constituents in Slaughter County, some of the officials there, and they say, hey, wait a second, all these people that are making this great agreement, they're talking about flooding a lot of our land, which is very productive farmland right now, and at least take us into account. So I think the governor's pushing forward with it. I think the governor wants this done before he leaves office. And my hope and what I've tried to do is to say, as you're coming to your agreement, listen to the people in the area that are going to be directly affected. And if we can at least get that, at least we'll have our voices heard and we'll have an opportunity to mitigate what could be problems in our area. But, I mean, let's look at where the votes are, folks. Let's look where the population is in this state. There are a lot more of them than there are us, so to speak. So the question is, how do you have them pay attention to our concerns in a serious way?
Well, first of all, I'm going to turn this way so that you... and I can certainly relate to reading doctor's prescriptions and going through these cards. I'm trying to do the best I can here. Civil disobedience, as it were. I apologize, I missed the back part of a question here that goes in going back to health care, that the U.S. is ranked about number 40th, according to the World Health Organization, and that Australia has a far superior universal health care plan. Are you familiar with the Australia plan, and why aren't we looking to that as a model?
I'll be happy to look at that. I haven't heard of that being a model. I've heard of the French system, the British system, the Canadian system. I'll be happy to look at the Australian system. But frankly, if any, what'd you say, 40th?
40th.
They can say that, I don't believe it. I mean, I've been to a lot of those countries. I will tell you this, I wouldn't be alive today if it weren't for American medicine. Guess where the Saudi Arabian royal family goes for medical care? United States.
Mayo Clinic.
And some other places too. But primarily Mayo Clinic. I don't know, that's a pretty good indication that when you got all the money in the world and you want to go someplace to get your health care, you choose this country rather than any other.
Purely coincidental that you would mention the Saudi family, and I'm going to make this adjustment here. Talking about national security defense spending, and the questions are, how come the administration cuts funds for unproven technology like missile defense and YF-22, yet is committed to billions to truly unproven technology, it says solar, wind. And then there's a question regarding North Korea's recent missile launch, and what do you think the United States' position should be And then there's a question on the Iraq War and whether or not there were no weapons of mass destruction, and was it worth the death of the U.S. citizens to fight in the Iraq War, and why?
On the first part, on missile defense, I've been a supporter of the missile defense system since 1979. And I remember what Ronald Reagan said when he was a candidate for president before he was elected in 1980. He went to NORAD Command, which is North American air defense system that used to be in the Cheyenne Mountain in the Great West. And our commander of that command, of that that system, pointed out to him how we could track, if the Soviet Union were to launch their missiles, we'd know when they were launched, and we could track them coming all the way here to the United States. And the president said, well, what do you do in response? He said, well, then we launch our missiles on them. It was called, and is called, mutual assured destruction. Some people call it MAD. And the whole idea was that if the Soviets launched on us to kill 10 million Americans, we'd launch on them to kill 30 million Russians. And so they wouldn't do it. I've always wondered about the morality of that. But Ronald Reagan's question was a very simple one. He said, wouldn't it be better if we had a defense so we could shoot down their missiles rather than having only the response of being able to kill more of them than they could kill of us? And that was his vision. And the interesting thing was, that's 1979. We're now 2009. By my calculations, that's 30 years. His vision was what broke the back of the Soviet Union. And Mikhail Gorbachev has said in his memoirs that when Ronald Reagan would not give up the missile defense system that the United States was pursuing, he knew that the Soviet Union could no longer compete with us, and it was over. Now, the interesting thing was, that occurred in about 1987, 88. So that's 20 years ago. Our technology then was crude compared to what we have now. Right now, we have the capability of having successful missile defense systems. And now is the time people are talking about getting rid of them. A strange thing happened on the floor of the House. The Democratic majority in the House was objecting to the full development of the missile defense program that President Bush had. And so, one of our great allies, the State of Israel, realizes it needs a defense system. And so we put in multi-millions of dollars that Israel could use on this so long as they work with us. And when we did that, the Democratic majority went along with us. Now, I don't know if you saw the story that Israel just had a successful launch on their missile defense system yesterday. The argument has been, look, you can never have a missile system that's 100%, missile defense system that's 100% successful. And that's absolutely correct. You don't need one that's 100% successful. You need one that is successful enough such that it is irrational for the other side to launch, because they have to launch too many missiles to do the kind of destruction they need. Now, that's if you have a system that's going to destroy things. There's another very important development that we've lost sight of. It's called electromagnetic pulse, EMP. It was something that was very big during the Cold War. After the Cold War, we sort of lost sight of it. What's electromagnetic pulse? It's if you explode a nuclear weapon at a certain elevation, a certain altitude, the electromagnetic pulse that it creates does not destroy people, it doesn't kill you, but it knocks out entire systems. And there are some that would suggest that it could disable cars, disable trucks, disable airplanes, disable our communication system, disable our electrical grid, disable our SCADA systems, which are the systems that run our water projects and so forth. In other words, it could render us incapable not only of defending ourselves, but incapable of operating as a society in the way that we understand. Now, why is this important? you don't need an accurate delivery system for that. In other words, you don't need to have it actually hit a target. You need to have it get to a certain elevation and explode the nuclear device at that elevation, and then the pulse that comes down affects everything in that area. And so if you look at what Iran's doing, if you look at what North Korea's doing, you got to be worried. They don't have to have first generation, this generation missile delivery systems. They can have older, less accurate ones. You could put something off, you could have a delivery system that is disguised as a tramp steamer coming close to our coastline and have it launch there. If you believe what Iran's doing, they could do it from a great distance and hit parts of the United States. So a missile defense system is even more important today than ever before. It broke the back of the Soviet Union when we didn't have the technology, and now when we are on the verge of true complete systems with technology, people want it to turn it down. I think it's madness, and frankly, I will continue to support a missile defense system because I think it's more humane than saying, if you dare kill 10 of my countrymen, I'm going to kill 1,000 of yours. I would rather be in the position of attempting to defend ourselves against it, creating a defense shield, essentially.
The next one moves on to the Food Modernization Bill, H.R. 875.
You didn't answer about the Iraq war, the soldiers dying.
The Iraq war.
That's the last part of the question. Was it worth it? Which is one of my questions.
Well, I was not in Congress when they voted for basically an affirmation of the president's decision to go to war. But based on the information that was available at that time, I probably would have voted to support it. Do I think that liberating a people from a bloodthirsty dictator who was a threat to the stability of that part of the world and creating the possibility of a working democracy in a Muslim country in the middle of the Middle East, which could stabilize that part of the world in ways we haven't seen in generations, was that something worthy of the sacrifice of Americans? I would have to say yes. Did we think there were weapons of mass destruction, and was that part of one of 15 reasons, I think, that were included in the authorization of force? If we thought they were, I wish we would have found them. The fact of the matter is, our intelligence community thought they were there. The Israeli intelligence community thought they were there. The French intelligence community thought they were there. The British intelligence community thought they were there. And we were wrong. In part, it appears that Saddam Hussein was basically lying to some of his own people about what they thought they had. Now, they'd had some weapons of mass destruction, not the ones we were looking for, because he used them on the Kurds several years before. But we did not find the weapons of mass destruction we thought was there. I've been reading a book sporadically over the last year called Crusade in Europe. It's Dwight D. Eisenhower's memoirs of World War II. And in there, he talks about how in a wartime situation, he talks about the fog of war, which a lot of people talk about. But he talks about the fact, and he gives incident after incident after incident during World War II, particularly with our invasion, our liberation of Normandy, of where intelligence was faulted. And he made the point that in a war atmosphere, you never get perfect intelligence. You make the decisions based on what you think you have. But time and time again, you are reminded that intelligence is never perfect, and you're often going to be misled. It was interesting because I wasn't looking for that when I was reading the book. I was reading the book because I had a chance last year to go to Normandy where my dad had been some 60 years before. And I was reading Eisenhower's memoirs, and I was struck by that. Among other things, he made a number of tremendous observations in there as well, but that was one of them.
Thank you, sir. Okay, Food Modernization Bill, H.R. 875. Both of the questions regarding that bill are in opposition to it. They're afraid of the regulations that it would put on pesticide and herbicide use. And one person here has started a petition against it that will be coming your way. And then, sort of on a related note, as a comment, the EPA recently ruled on pesticides in the Clean Water Act, allowing mosquito districts to treat adult mosquitoes flying above and near waters. The EPA has been challenged in court as a trustee for the SAC Yolo Mosquito Vector Control District. We want the EPA to continue its direction and work hard to maintain its stance regarding pesticides for mosquito control. So back to H.R. 875.
Well, I guess I'm going to get their petition. I'm going to read it. I've not really investigated that particular issue. We have to look at it. Again, it's always a balance. It's a balance of risks. One thing I've learned is that we don't live in a risk-free society, and so you have to balance your risk. What are the benefits versus the downside to certain types of pesticides? I mean, when you say pesticides, that covers a whole range of substances. I understand what they're saying. We've done some things in the past where I have objected to banning certain pesticides, and at other times it appears to be a reasonable thing to do. So I have to look at specifically what they're talking about with respect to that bill and how it affects us here in California.
Okay, I've been told that 8:30 was the scheduled ending time, so I will try to get down to some of these more direct questions. What is your position on H.R. 450, which is the Enumerated Powers Act?
I don't know what the Enumerated Powers Act is. I know what the Enumerated Powers are in the Constitution, but I don't know what that act is.
The Enumerated Powers Act is the one that would require Congress to show the constitutionality of the law before it's passed.
Oh, okay.
Where it's represented.
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't seen that. I'd be happy to look at that. We have a requirement right now that we have to know what the impact on the budget would be. And we do have a requirement right now that you have to say what the authority is for it. But if you are saying it has to be more explicit, I'd be happy to look at it. I know I get papers on every bill that comes through that analyzes whether there's a constitutional or an arguable constitutional basis for it.
This would require that Congress to show the constitutionality before it can be passed, not just look to see if it's constitutional.
Well, let me put it this way. It's awfully difficult these days when you've got courts that find things in the Constitution that haven't been there for 200 years, and then they can't find things that are right there. We just had a vote on something very emotional on the floor of the House. It was whether or not we ought to tax people who got executive bonuses for companies that received something from the TARP program. We're going to tax them 90%. And somebody asked Charlie Rangel, who's had trouble paying his own taxes. Somebody asked him, he happened to be chairman of Ways and Means, why didn't you tax them 100%? He said, well, we figured with state and local taxes, they would be taxed. Now, here's the problem. A bill of attainder is prohibited in the Constitution. A bill of attainder is a punishment which is directed at an individual or an easily ascertainable group of people. A punishment without a crime. Now, I happen to think 90% tax on somebody is a punishment. And it was after the fact. Now, I didn't agree with the bonuses that were given. And it was like a mob scene on Congress. They were on the floor with Congress saying, oh my God, look what they did. We've got to give. And I stood there and I said, wait a minute. The Constitution says we can't do this. If this isn't a bill of attainder, an ex post facto law, I don't know what it is. And I don't think it was that difficult to be able to see it. And that's what I mean. Sometimes people can't find something in the Constitution. We had another thing on the DC. The litigation that went all the way to the court with the DC gun bill. And I was one of a number of members of Congress who signed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief to the Supreme Court, stating that we believe that the DC bill was unconstitutional and that, in fact, if you read the Second Amendment, it says that you have a right to keep and bear arms and that went to the individual, not just to the militia. Now, the Supreme Court never ruled on that. It's the first time in history they ever ruled on it, and they said, actually, if you read the Constitution and you read the Second Amendment and you understand language that was understood at that time and the history of it, in fact, people do have an individual right to keep and bear arms. Now, some people may not like that, but that's what the Constitution says. There's another issue in the Congress right now, and it's whether or not the District of Columbia ought to get a voting member of Congress in the House of Representatives. Now, what they've done is they said, here's the deal, we'll strike. This was to get Senator Hatch's support in the Senate. We'll give Utah an extra new vote, so that will presumably be Republican, because we know the one in D.C. will be Democrat, so you guys vote for it. Well, the problem is the U.S. Constitution says in several parts that the House of Representatives shall be made up of the representatives of the individual states. Then it goes on to say that a member of Congress must be a resident of the state from which he is elected. It doesn't say the District of Columbia. The District of Columbia is not a state. The District of Columbia was specifically set up because it was not a state. Because the fear that if you put the capital in a state, that state would have undue influence over the federal representatives. In fact, during the convention, they argued about, I think, it was Hamilton, I forget who it was, brought forth a proposal to give the District of Columbia a vote in the House of Representatives. It was rejected. So what do? They say, well, wait a second, there's another part of the Constitution that says the Congress has plenary powers over the District of Columbia. Ah, plenary powers mean we can do anything. Therefore, we can violate the other part of the Constitution. So we have voted out a bill of the House of Representatives that gives the District of Columbia the right to have a voting member of the House of Representatives. Now, I think that's blatantly unconstitutional. In fact, Professor Turley, who you see on TV sometimes, said it was the most intentionally blatant violation of the Constitution he'd ever seen the Congress pass. Now, that's hard to get to that spot. But that's the kind of nonsense. I hear on the floor of the House people saying, I've had this argument, doesn't matter what we do, the courts will decide. So they say, don't worry about whether you think it's constitutional. I took an oath to uphold the Constitution. I know I have an obligation to do so. And I'll tell you, if this Supreme Court rules that D.C. can get a voting member of the House of Representatives, then there's nothing that's sacred in the Constitution. It's not in a penumbra. It's not emanating from anything. It's actually there.
Okay, we've exceeded the end time, so let me just go through the questions here that we didn't get to.
Oh, yes, and let everybody know, those questions that we've got, if they put their name on the back, we'll answer it on the website. Okay, we'll do it that way. For those questions we didn't get to, we will put answers on our website for those questions so that you and anybody else can see those as well. So we don't need your name. We'll just put it on the website.
And there were also questions about who they contact or submit comments regarding areas of concern or more engagement with your office. And so I imagine they can
go to the website, lumber.house.gov.
Very good.
Or they call our office at 859-9906. Finally got my number down.
So what we didn't get to was Social Security and lost retirement fund contributions. Some more discussion on the cap and trade, how it affects low income and whether or not businesses are being set up as brokers. Climate change, creating a global currency, the death penalty and your position on that. And then this, I love this, I have a hard time remembering what I had for breakfast, but the question is, what happened September 18th, 2008? So it's a $5 billion taken out in 1 hour, who and what entity did this, so I don't know.
Or did you let your check them?
September 18th?
September 18th, 2008.
Money market, if I didn't, if I understand correctly, that's when we realized we had the economic crisis. And all of a sudden that hit us. We thought energy was a big issue, and all of a sudden that hit us. I think it was September 18th, I thought it was September 20th. I say 18th, but that's the thing.
So with that, I certainly appreciate you coming out, being very candid. Appreciate you coming down the road.